Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Northwest News features include reports from Tom Bonsey looking at energy and the environment. We'll hear about supporters and opponents of a Nestle water bottling plant proposed for the small town of Cascade Locks. Measure 1455 comes up for the vote on May 17th, and if it passes, it will effectively end Nestle's plans for a plant. We'll hear comments from Aurora Del Val, the campaign director of the Local Water Alliance. And we'll also hear challenges in Oregon's foster care system and ideas to make cities and housing age-friendly. This is The Bridge for the week of April 28th. In our first story, the future of nuclear energy was discussed at an international conference in Atlanta, Georgia last week. Correspondent Tom Bonsey reports there was heavy presence from the Northwest at that gathering.
The chief commercial officer of Oregon-based NuScale Power gave the keynote address to the Advanced Nuclear Reactor Conference. NuScale is leading the charge to develop a new generation of small modular reactors, billed as cheaper, safer, and faster to build. Mike McHugh presented a detailed timeline for deployment of his company's first plant outside Idaho Falls,
which will be commercially operational in middle of 2024. So I know that's 8 years from now. That seems like a long time, but in the space of what we're doing and in technology development and deployment, it's actually quite short.
First, though, NuScale has to get design approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a process that involves a 12,000-page application to be submitted this fall, followed by 3 or more years of review. I'm Tom Bonsey reporting.
People who are interested in solar energy but don't have the perfect roof on which to install solar panels may have the option to buy into a bigger, centrally located project. These are called shared solar or community solar. There's a boomlet of such projects in Washington State right now, while there are hardly any in sunnier Oregon and Idaho. Tom Bonsey continues his look at our energy with Washington's general solar incentives coming under scrutiny.
Single mother Chris Anderson says she looked into adding some kind of renewable energy to her home in Shelton, Washington, but it was daunting. Then last year, the electric company in her area invited customers to invest in a shared solar array on the roof of the utility's operations center.
This opportunity is easy. I mean, it's literally the easy button. Okay, here's my check, but I'm doing a good thing.
Anderson is one of thousands of people around the Northwest who've bought shares in a community solar project developed either by their utility or a local nonprofit. Justin Holsgrove of Mason County Public Utility District No. 3 leads me onto the roof to see the project Anderson and her friends bought into.
So, glad you brought your sunglasses. It's nice and bright up here, which is perfect for solar.
Holsgrove says his utility and others around the state had to turn people away.
We had twice as many people register for solar units than we had solar units available. So there was a lot of interest in this.
And then what kind of payback period did you promise investors?
Yeah, so we promised a 3 to 4 year payback period. We estimated, probably a better word, we estimated a 3 to 4 year payback period, which is fantastic. When you're looking at putting a rooftop solar system on your own home, a private home, you're looking at a 10 to 15, maybe even a 20-year payback period, depending on, you know, your site's location.
This community solar project offered customers an unusual combination of low risk and high reward, plus none of the hassles of building or maintaining a residential solar array. It pays back like this. The utility pays you for your share of the electricity produced, usually as a credit on your bill. In addition, Washington State gives utilities a tax break to incentivize green energy, and the utility passes all of that through to its solar customers. Holsgrove says the state subsidy is many multiples greater than the value of the electricity generated.
With community solar, the state production incentives that are available really makes it lucrative to get into it.
It's probably no coincidence there are more than 50 of these community solar projects registered in Washington State compared to just a handful in sunnier Oregon and Idaho. They have no state incentives for shared solar. The going rate for electricity is cheap in the Northwest, so the pioneering shared solar projects in Oregon that rely on power revenue alone may never fully pay back their participants. In Washington State, there's a catch, isn't there always? The program is too popular. A surge in solar installations is pushing more than a dozen Washington utilities up to a cap on incentive payouts. Solar installer Jeremy Smithson of Seattle supported a proposed overhaul of the incentives at the legislature, raising the cap but lowering the subsidy payments to future solar adopters. It didn't pass. So big Washington utilities are notifying solar array owners their annual checks could be reduced because their programs are oversubscribed.
For most people, it's just going to take longer, you know, for that project to pencil out. We do have some people who took out loans, and they were counting on the incentives to help them make the payments.
Separately, an analyst at the conservative-leaning Washington Policy Center think tank criticizes the solar subsidies as an extremely expensive way to make the Northwest's already pretty clean power generation a tiny bit greener. But the legislature ignored that critique in favor of spurring a local solar industry. I'm Tom Bonsi in Shelton, Washington.
This week, the United States Senate passed a bipartisan amendment sponsored by Senators Jeff Merkley and Chuck Grassley. It restores funding for wind energy research and development. The amendment was attached to fiscal year 2017 Energy and Water Appropriations Bill. Specifically, the Merkley-Grassley Amendment restores funding for wind energy research to $95.4 million, the same level as in 2016. The initial draft of the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill had contained a $15.4 million cut to the program, down to just $80 million. The Department of Energy's Wind Energy Program provides a critical platform to maintain the pace of innovation in wind energy that has allowed the cost of wind energy to drop dramatically and allowed for the rapid growth in renewable energy across the country. States like Oregon and Iowa have recently seen a sharp increase in the share of wind generation, with Oregon currently generating 11.3% of the state's total energy from wind power. While wind energy supplied just 4.7% of the total electricity generated in the United States in 2015, the Department of Energy's Wind Vision report shows that wind energy could supply as much as 35% of electricity demand by 2050. Come July, a wider range of fully electric and extended range plug-in hybrid cars will benefit from a sales tax break in Washington State. Governor Jay Inslee has signed legislation to raise the cutoff for a tax incentive. J.J. McCoy of the Seattle Electric Vehicle Association says that means the upcoming Tesla Model 3, Chevy Bolt, and the next generation Nissan Leaf should qualify.
I really think once those cars are hitting showrooms and are properly incentivized, we're really going to see electric vehicle adoption take off because it's a very exciting offering.
Beginning in July, the sales tax exemption applies to the first $32,000 of the selling price of a qualifying electric car. That nets a tax savings between $2,600 to over $3,000 for electric car buyers, depending on where the dealer is located in Washington. The sales tax varies slightly from county to county. Washington's alternative fuel vehicle sales tax exemption is slated to expire midway through 2019. McCoy said the Washington legislature trimmed the value of the EV sales tax breaks from the current $35,000 maximum exemption to offset the hit to state treasuries from the expanding number of qualifying vehicle models. The sales tax break is currently limited to alternative vehicles with sales prices up to $35,000. This winter, EV enthusiasts and automakers convinced lawmakers to raise the threshold to include vehicles where the base model had a manufacturer's suggested retail price of up to $42,500. McCoy said that level captures the mid-market.
Thank you.
The debate over a proposed Nestle bottling plant in the Columbia Gorge town of Cascade Locks is reaching a boiling point. The city is just 3 weeks away from the results on Measure 1455, which would ban producing and exporting more than 1,000 gallons of bottled water per day in Hood River County. If the measure passes, Aurora Del Val with the Local Water Alliance in Cascade Locks says other cities could follow their lead by also banning large water bottling operations.
We don't want to set the precedent of being a bottled water export county, but we do want to set the precedent for communities around the country.
At issue are the potential effects a large bottling facility could have on the town's water supply. Del Valle says residents of towns in California, Connecticut, and Montana also have contacted the alliance with similar issues. During a raucous meeting last week, the Cascade Locks City Council voted 6-1 to oppose limiting bottled water production, saying the plant would bring jobs to the economically hard-hit town. While Del Valle says she sees the reasons for the council's decision, she's worried Nestle could drain the town's water supply, leaving residents high and dry.
I understand their concern about economic development, but we really think that nothing can hurt Cascade Locks more than trading away the security of our water supply throughout our county.
The Nestle company has tried to gain the water rights to Oxbow Springs since 2008. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs of Oregon also support the bottled water production limit. And Western Washington will soon get new telephone area codes next year, pending a vote of the State Utilities Commission. Idaho is rolling out a new area code as well. Tom Bonsi explains.
Population growth and the proliferation of mobile devices mean phone numbers for new customers are running out, and Western Washington's 360. The old way to provide relief was to split a territory and assign half the people a new area code. But now the go-to option is to overlay a new code, says Washington Utilities Commission spokeswoman Anna Gill.
Well, it's easier for customers because you won't have to have any customers change their telephone numbers. This way, new customers are really the only ones that are going to be affected as far as having new numbers.
One consequence of an overlay is mandatory 10-digit dialing for local calls. That's phased in before a new area code launches in the 360 area code territory of Western Washington. That comes later next year. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Oregon and British Columbia have years of experience by now with area code overlays. In Portland, Salem, and Northwest Oregon, the 503 code territory was overlaid with area code 971 in 1999. In the rest of Oregon, the area code 458 provides overflow relief for the 541 area codes. The new area code to get to know in Western Washington will be 564, and in Idaho, the new area code will be 986. You're listening to The Bridge. Years before 3D printing was widely used, a bald eagle named Beauty was given a second chance at life because of the technology. These days, the bird's story influences people who visit its northern Idaho home. Frankie Barnhill has the story.
Raptor biologist Janie Veldkamp first met Beauty in 2007. Beauty is a 14-year-old bald eagle, and back then the bird was struggling to survive. She had been illegally shot in the wild and lost her upper beak from the trauma. Without her upper beak, which is vital to eating, she wasn't expected to live very long. But Veldkamp, who is the founder and director of Birds of Prey Northwest in northern Idaho, had an idea. The former nurse wondered if creating and attaching a prosthetic beak could help Beauty. A year and a half later, a team attached the first 3D-printed prosthetic beak to Beauty's head. Veldkamp says the bird's unique temperament helped a lot.
Beauty has a very calm temperament for such a bird, and it's one of the reasons I decided to take on her case. It's not very scientific, but she seems to have a sense that we're trying to help her.
The biologist says Beauty is not just a good test subject. Veldkamp says the bird is an example of the dangers posed by illegal poachers on bald eagles. Although her prosthetic beak helps her feed and take care of herself, Beauty will never be able to live in the wild. Now, more people will get the chance to hear Beauty's story. The bird will be featured in an April 30th episode on the National Geographic Channel. Reporting in Boise, I'm Frankie Barnhill.
Walls are going up around Puget Sound, and the Sound is paying for it. In Seattle's King County, property owners have walled off most of the shoreline with concrete bulkheads and other heavy infrastructure. A new study suggests the practice known as shoreline armoring is more helpful to Puget Sound than previously thought. John Ryan has details from West Seattle.
Amy Kinney is digging with her hands in the gravel of Alki Beach. She's a biologist at the University of Washington, Tacoma.
I see lots of little sand fleas jumping around. Do you see those?
Most of Alki Beach is a city park. A concrete seawall separates the popular beach from the road and buildings above it. But this little stretch of beach below a waterfront house has logs, driftwood, and some kelp and eelgrass piled up at the high tide line. It's a more natural shoreline, and the sand fleas like it here.
So this is a really important food source for the young salmon just coming out of the rivers to bulk up on.
Beaches that haven't been walled off by concrete or rock piles are an increasingly rare commodity in Puget Sound. In all, the Sound loses nearly a mile of shoreline to armoring each year, and the damage stretches beyond that walled-off mile. A new study by UW researchers says a new seawall can damage the shoreline habitat of neighboring areas.
Of course, that all adds up to Puget Sound-wide or Sailor Sea-wide, so it's not just you and your neighbors, it's the whole broad ecosystem.
Megan DeTier with UW's Friday Harbor Labs is the lead author of that study. Researchers and local officials say homeowners often armor their shorelines illegally, but local governments lack the ability to enforce shoreline regulations.
These conflicts are likely to get worse as sea levels rise with our changing climate and more waterfront owners try to protect their properties from the rising seas. On Alki Beach, I'm John Ryan.
You're listening to The Bridge. Now we take a look at housing and care for the most vulnerable in our state. Oregon is falling short of many of its own goals when it comes to caring for children in its foster care system. That's according to a review released this week. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has the details.
The report found that Oregon's Department of Human Services falls short in a number of key areas. Those include the speed and frequency of investigations of abuse, the number of repeat occurrences of mistreatment of children in the foster care system, and a lack of access to mental health treatment. The report was compiled with the help of DHS employees and outside agencies. It's part of a periodic federal review of the state's foster care system. The review is meant to document compliance with federal child welfare requirements. Oregon's report shows little to no improvement since the last report in 2008. The review comes as the Department of Human Services has come under increased scrutiny by lawmakers and Governor Kate Brown for the way it oversees the foster care system. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
Oregon lawmakers were quick to react to the report. Republican Representative Dwayne Stark called it, quote, a sobering reminder of how broken our state's child welfare system is. Democrats have also been critical of the state's foster care system, but Democratic Senator Sarah Gessler says she's hopeful the actions taken to overhaul the agency will lead to better outcomes in the future. In another story of Oregon children at risk, we learn that when parents are incarcerated, their children are punished too. More than 68,000 children in Oregon have a parent in prison, according to a report released last week by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Scott Spencer of the foundation says children of the incarcerated, 28% of whom are age 4 or younger, are missing out at a crucial period in their lives.
They're losing their parent in those critical years of child development. And so there are some long-standing impacts. It can increase a child's mental health issues, such as depression and anxiety, and it can hamper educational achievement in that child.
The report also finds that nearly two-thirds of families with incarcerated members struggle to afford basic needs. If, for example, a father is incarcerated, household income drops by nearly a quarter. The report suggests states should adopt policies to help families, such as financial, legal, and child care assistance. Oregon already has a ban-the-box law in place that prohibits employers from asking potential employees about their criminal backgrounds on applications, making it easier for the recently released to get a job. And while this is a good step, Spencer says states should go further to ensure stable households for children.
State and local governments should provide incentives for housing authorities and private landlords to lift restrictions on people with records so that families can remain in or access safe and affordable housing.
According to the report, 8% of children in Oregon have had a parent in prison. That's on par with the national average. You're listening to The Bridge. We take one more look at housing for the most vulnerable of our state. A mayor forum in Portland hosted by AARP last Saturday has citizens thinking about what they can do to become more livable for older adults. In Lane County, Springfield has joined Portland on the AARP's list of cities that are age-friendly by making the city more accessible. Neil Lodotti is a community relations manager for the city of Springfield. He says officials toured the city with seniors to find out how to accommodate the community's needs.
Everything from how the crossings work, how the buttons work, to are the benches accessible? Not just are they accessible, but are they easy to get in and out of? And do we use that when we design new areas of town?
Oregon's population of adults 65 and older is expected to grow by 48% between 2010 and 2020. Building homes with specifications such as wider hallways and more convenient electrical outlets is important to making seniors more independent. Don Bruland is a retiree in Medford who volunteers with AARP. He says some of the design adjustments can be costly, but homes built to specifications for older adults are very popular.
We have between 40 and 50 houses now that have been built in our area to these specifications. And what the builder finds is they're sold before it can finish them.
Bruland adds accessible transportation is important for keeping older generations involved in civic activities. Lodotti says it's been a challenge in Springville simply making housing available at all.
How do we help seniors if they get displaced, number one, and then what kind of options do you have in your city for seniors or low-income housing?
Springfield, Oregon has been a part of AARP's network of age-friendly communities since 2015. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We enjoy hearing from you. Email us at newsone, that's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.